I think has to be understood in the context of who we are in relationship with God. As human beings, the scriptures are explicit that we are made in the image of God, and therefore we're made as persons capable of having relationship with God. Because we're made in the image of God, therefore we have great dignity. And I would have to say that man is, or mankind, men and women, are by nature good. When I use the word by, I'm using a preposition advisedly. I'm talking about the essential nature of man. I would have to say, though, that in our nature, and that preposition is a preposition of intrusion, in our nature we're fallen and we're in desperate condition. When theologians talk about the depravity of man, they're not saying man's not capable of good. As a matter of fact, if you look at Paul, Paul will say, "In me dwelleth no good thing." But he can't be contradicting Jesus, who says, "If you being evil know how to give good gifts to your children." So how do we bring those texts together in a way that shows that the Bible is a coherent book and a consistent book and not a book full of contradictions? And I think when Jesus is speaking about the fact that even fallen people and broken people can do good, he's emphasizing the fact that we're made in the image of God. Paul, when he's talking about "in me dwelleth no good thing," is not saying "in me dwelleth no good thing at all." He's saying "in me dwelleth no salvifically meritorious thing, whereby God is obligated to save me because of some good that I've done." When I started first grade, one third of my first grade class were in polio braces. You don't see anybody in polio braces anymore, because Jonas Salk, an atheist physician, cured polio. He did a great and good act. It wasn't salvifically meritorious. The only way a person gets to heaven is by what Jesus did for us at the cross. But it was a great and good act, and people benefited wisely. How we think about the nature of man affects our theology at least four ways. Some people think man's essentially sinful. If that was true, it would affect your theology proper, your doctrine of God. God would have had to have made us essentially sinful. That doesn't fit my theology, nor is it coherent with Revelation and Scripture. Second, it affects your doctrine of Christ, your Christology. Jesus took on human nature. He became fully man without sacrificing the fact that he was fully God. For him to become man, if sin is essential to what it means to be human, he would have had to become a sinner. But the scriptures are explicit. He wasn't fallen, and there was no sin found in him. Third, it affects your biblical anthropology, or your biblical doctrine of man. We have four categories of man in the scriptures. Adam and Eve before the fall, sin's not present. Adam and Eve and all who follow after, a huge category, sin is present. Christ in his humanity, sin is not present. Man in his glorified state, we don't morph into something other than human in heaven. We become glorified humans, but sin is not present. Four categories of man in Scripture. Sin's only present in one. It can't be the defining characteristic. And then fourthly is your doctrine of salvation, or soteriology. If you see a pig wallowing in the mire, you don't kick the pig. The pig is living according to its nature. It has no sweat glands. It has to wallow to keep its body cool. But if you see a man living in sin and degradation, do you tell him he shouldn't be living like that? Of course you do. If he's living according to his nature, let him go, like you let the pig go. But if he's living contrary to his nature, you tell him he needs Jesus, that the image of Christ might be fully restored. So I think that that's what it means to be that's how we understand who we are. Now, it goes beyond that, too, because we also have to understand that we are creatures, though we have plumbed the depths of our depravity. John Gerstner, the theologian, said that the doctrine of total depravity of man doesn't mean we're as bad as we could be. There's still room for deprovement. But nevertheless, we are also people deeply loved by God. It's amazing to me. I think about the Bible, and I think if this book came from the omniscient God, he didn't give us very much. It says in the scriptures, if everything might have been written about Jesus, it could have been written, the libraries of the world couldn't have contained all the books. So in some senses, he didn't give us very much. And yet, as I look at the Bible, I shouldn't worry about the limited bit that we have from the omniscience, because I'm not good at obeying what's in there, let alone needing more, you see. But when I read through the Bible and I come to Chronicles, chapters 1 through 12, I think to myself, Lord, was this a good economic use of space that you put 12 chapters of names in there? And then the light goes on. To me, they're names. To To him, everyone was a person deeply loved by God. And I imagine him saying, if you could have seen and known Sarah, oh, if only you would have known Simeon, what struggles he had, and yet I loved him in the midst of every one. And I imagine as I read those chapters that God is saying to me, oh, I love the people I have made. And I read them and remind myself that he loves people. Romans 5:8, but God proved his love for us, and that while we were yet sinners, no matter how far we drifted, his love did not cease. And that's who we are. People made in his image, people fallen, yet people deeply loved by him, so that he would turn heaven and earth upside down to reconcile us to himself.